from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. America's TV cameras have been all over Chicago in the last week, looking at picket lines and the often poor children Chicago's teachers are supposed to serve. What happens to America's poorest children in school years and beyond? My guest today, Jonathan Kozol, knows. He's followed these lives intimately, personally. He's got the stories of the living and the dead and what made the difference. This hour on Point, Jonathan Kozol and America's poorest children. You can join the conversation. Have you lived it, seen it, worked to end it? What have you learned? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now in the studio is Jonathan Kozol. He's a teacher, researcher, longtime advocate for the poorest kids in the nation. He's been called America's conscience. His new book is Fire in the Ashes, 25 Years Among the Poorest Children in America. Jonathan Kozol, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you, Tom. Good to be here.
25 years and really more than that since you first started writing about this, so in such a well-known way back in the 1960s. But here you've got a particular generation of children that you followed from dire poverty into adulthood, if they made it that far. Take us back to this generation of kids that you're profiling, whose path you're profiling in this book. Where did you first come to know them, and what kind of years and circumstances?
Okay. Starting in the late 1980s and then the early 1990s, I began to spend a lot of time with a bunch of young kids, little kids, in the South Bronx of New York. I'd met a few of them earlier when they were homeless, when they were in homeless shelters.
In Manhattan, in the middle of Manhattan.
Right near Times Square. And it was a pretty sordid setting. Most of them were in one notorious hotel.
The Martinique.
The Martinique. And it was an awful place, and it had a particularly devastating effect, not so much on the littlest kids who didn't know what was going on, but more on the pre-adolescent boys who could see the open drug sales in the building and who had to go out in the street and panhandle to raise money to buy food for their families.
And could see the way their own penniless mothers were preyed on by those who were supposed to be helping them.
That's right. The guards in the building were, many of them were ex-prison cons, and they would take advantage of the women, you know, exploit them sexually in exchange for favors. But the city closed down those shelters. At the end of 1989, 1990, approximately then, and moved almost all the families I knew into the absolutely poorest section of the South Bronx, a neighborhood called Mott Haven, which was then and is still today the poorest neighborhood in the poorest congressional district in America. I followed them.
That is saying something.
And it's still true to this day. The average family income in the neighborhood at this moment is, like, for a family of three or four, is $17,000. Imagine that in New York. Now, some of the parents I'd known when they were homeless invited me. They'd say, you know, we'd become friends. So come for Thanksgiving, things like that.
Wow.
So I followed them there. And then I got to know all these other little kids who were going through a scenario that was right out of Charles Dickens. I mean, they lived in these horrible buildings. There was a complex of 38 slum buildings. They were owned, I'm embarrassed to say, by a landlord who lives here in Boston, who's been in the news a good deal, rather notorious. I won't name him. There were horrible buildings. The elevators never worked. One little boy fell in the elevator shaft when the elevator door opened, but there wasn't any elevator there. He fell four flights to his death.
And you write that no one knew until his blood began dripping on elevator passengers.
That's right, exactly.
Unbelievable.
I knew these kids well. The schools in the neighborhood were among, with one exception, were among the worst I had seen anywhere in the United States.
There's a scene, if I may, Jonathan Kozol, earlier, before the homeless leave Manhattan, when some of them are panhandling in the streets. They're not far from Times Square, which means they're not far from Broadway. And at this time, we're back in the 80s, and the hot, big, new show that's on there is Les Mis.
Right.
And here are you paint this scene of Americans coming out of this thrilling musical presentation of poverty and degradation and uprising in hundreds of years ago in France. And in the streets right in front of them are Les Miserables, the miserable of New York, of the United States of America, and they don't want to see them.
That's right. I mean, people did not want to spend $50 or whatever it cost in those days to see a fictional and enjoyable play about the poor children of Paris and then come out at the end on the street and see the real thing right in front of them. In the past few years, people have said to me, what happened to all those kids? Because I wrote three books about them. Mm-hmm. And they want to know, you know, have I kept in touch with them? How many survived? How many did not survive? Mm-hmm. And the ones who did survive, you know, how did they get a decent education? How far did it take them? Where are they now? Well, it
turns out that you know in many cases because you've kept up with them, not just as a researcher, but as a family friend.
That's right. I mean, these kids, an awful lot of them became my closest friends, and those who survived are now young grown-ups. Mm-hmm. But some never did recover.
Tell us some stories. Maybe start with those who didn't, because there are plenty of those, and that's a pretty tough story.
There were a lot of kids who didn't survive. They're mostly boys. One boy had he'd just been so demoralized and his psyche so messed up by his early years of school and homelessness that he ended up shooting himself with a shotgun in the head.
You're talking about the boy you call Eric. You changed the names in this book, but
this
was a family who was actually, after having read your work, good people in Montana said, we want to help.
That's right.
And this family was taken off to Montana, and even there in a whole new environment, he couldn't escape the demons of that.
That's right. A wonderful man out there, a doctor who initiated all of this, said, I mean, he said, I did everything I could, and they were treated, and they were welcomed here. Mm-hmm. But he said, Eric could never overcome the damage that had already been done to him.
What was the damage? How do you interpret it, of his experience, that Dickensian poverty?
Well, he'd learned to be distrustful of grown-ups. Mm-hmm. He'd learned to use petty scams to get around difficult problems. Mm-hmm. He failed to learn anything in school, so he was way behind. Mm-hmm. And there were other factors also. Mm-hmm. Another boy whom I knew when he was 8 years old, I remember when he was homeless, he was a pale little boy panhandling out in the streets. He died of an overdose of heroin in his teenage years. And a third died by surfing on the tops of subway trains in New York City. For those who don't know what that means riding on the tops of
literally
the subway
climbing
trains.
Up on the old trains between the cars up onto the roof and then just hanging on for dear life as they fly under New York.
Well, most of them were smart and would lie flat on their stomachs. And he was smart, but in a moment of bravado, as if to say that nothing they've done to me can beat me down. Mm-hmm. He lifted his head and waved at his friends. Steel beam struck his skull, shuddered twice, and died.
This was the boy you call Silvio.
Yeah, and he wasn't 14 then. He wasn't even 14.
We're going to hear from his mother in the course of this hour. I mean, it's a terrible story, and he's not the only child that she lost in that poverty.
That's right.
We'll hear better stories as well, though. I can't exactly say that they're mainstream. Many of the survivors or flourishers that you write about, it seems only flourished because somebody took a special interest in them.
Well, that's the point. The majority, I mean, most of the people in Fire in the Ashes, most of the children in the book did survive. And that's the part that makes it an exciting story, I think, an adventure, because an awful lot of them, with the help of grown-ups, teachers or other people who intervened at crucial moments in their lives and fought aggressively on their behalf, have really won extraordinary victories. Some have won triumphant victories. There's one I talk about a lot in the book. She gets two chapters instead of one.
Pineapple, daughter of Guatemalan immigrant parents.
Yeah, because Pineapple was such an endearing little girl. I met her when she was six in kindergarten, and she was just a little charmer and very bossy. She used to push me around. She told me she did not like the way I
dressed. Better, Mr. Yep. Kozel. Get a new suit.
I had an old black suit, which I'd bought, which was a good suit when I bought it at Brooks Brothers 20 years before. Right, and she did not like it. She fingered
it. Don't be threadbare.
She fingered it with her hand and said, "Jonathan, you don't look respectable." She made me go out and buy a new suit.
She found her way with all that charm up and out, but she was not in the mainstream as she did that. She had special help. You say, what kind of democracy are we if we don't provide a mainstream path up and out of the most dire poverty? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking this hour about America's poorest children and what happens in their lives with a man who's tracked them for years, very up close and personal. Jonathan Kozel is with us. He won the National Book Award years and years ago for Death at an Early Age, The Destruction of Heart, the Hearts and Minds of Negro Children in the Boston Public Schools back in the 1960s. Then another generation he followed and wrote out of that many books, including Savage Inequalities and Amazing Grace, The Lives of Children and the Conscience of a Nation. In his new book, he goes back to look at those who survived, some thrived, and those who were lost coming up out of that most dire poverty. It is Fire in the Ashes, 25 Years Among the Poorest Children in America. He joins me today in the studio. Jonathan Kozel, in just a moment, we're going to hear from the mother of the young man you call Silvio, who tragically died subway surfing in New York. Remind us of his family's circumstances, brothers, sisters, the sort of a profile of what happened here. His mom will join us in a minute.
Well, Sylvia's mother, to start with, was just an extraordinary woman. She was very brave and gutsy, and she had been homeless for a time before she settled in the South Bronx.
She was in the Martinique Hotel, this horrible place in the Midtown.
Yeah, she'd been in several shelters, but she said that was the worst one. She called it a cesspool. Mm-hmm. Said it was the worst place in the world you could bring up children. She then was moved. When I say moved, it's too gentle. They were resettled by the city, often against their will, in a place where they could not be seen by too many other people, out of sight, in Mott Haven, in the Bronx.
After you had 60 Minutes cameras come into the hotel and
Nightline, actually.
Nightline, document the hellish
but,
scene there.
She had, in all, four boys. Two of them had not been born at that time. I met them later on in the 90s, but later in the 90s. But her two older boys, who had been home with her when she was homeless, suffered tremendous emotional damage, not only from the experience of being in that shelter, in that cesspool, as she called it, but also from the streets that surrounded them once they were moved to the Bronx, where at that time crack cocaine and needle drugs like heroin were everywhere. There was a table on the sidewalk. It was so obvious. I mean, you didn't have to guess. There was a table on the sidewalk in front of the church these folks attended where it was called a needle exchange, where addicted people could bring dirty needles in exchange for clean ones, because AIDS, HIV was
rearing
ravaging the neighborhood at that time. In fact, I noticed a few months ago when I was back there, that needle exchange is still there.
Wow.
So not that much has changed. But in any case, Ariella is a splendid human being. She'd had a lot of she didn't become homeless for any fault of her own. The reason she became homeless was because there was an explosion in the boiler of the building she was living in.
Mm-hmm.
She came through it all with extraordinary strength. She's now a community leader and she's been active in the Episcopal Church,
mm-hmm.
and the Episcopal Diocese of New York recently sent her to England and I believe to India also in order to advise parents on how to survive under destitute circumstances.
We need some of that perspective. Jonathan Kozel, please stand by. Ariella Patterson, and this, I should say, to be clear, is the pseudonym you use in the book, but she lives in the South Bronx, and she joins us right now from the South Bronx. Thank you very, very much for being with us today, if I may call you Ariella. Thanks for joining us.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
So you've got a lot of perspective on this. Heartbreak and difficult times. Jonathan Kozel, as he says, he describes you talking about some of the scenes where you were trying to raise children as the worst place in the world you could be with children. You say that people ask whether it was traumatizing, and you tell them traumatizing is too nice, too genteel. It was a nightmare. It was hell on earth. What's the long-term impact, Ariella?
It just gave me a fear of what would have happened to us and the ability, the strength to move forward. I had to do something better for my children, and I had to fight for us to get out of there. And we did. And they just kept moving us around to different places and different shelters. So we finally got into a family shelter, which is now called a Pier 2. And we were there for a while until they sent us to the South Bronx, which I thought was heaven on earth because it was like, oh, my God, a brand new community.
Mm-hmm.
Little did I know there was so much going on that would consume my children's lives and my life.
With my
ability to try to get them to a better point of teaching them something better. But I wasn't able to. The street just ate them up.
How many of your children did you lose, Ariella?
I lost one son to heaven and one son to the penal system at the tender age of 18. He had just turned 18, and he did 4 years of his life. And as a parent, I suffered those 4 years with him.
Take us back, and I'm sorry to raise it again, but Jonathan does it, and it's the life you've lived when the son that he calls Silvio lost his life subway surfing, and here you were. You thought you had come to a better place, to a good place with these kids, and now you had a son who was gone. Did you blame yourself? Did you blame, I don't know, the America, the wider society? How did you think about it at that time?
Oh, at that time, I was devastated. I just had a brand new little boy. He was only 3 months old. So I blamed myself a lot because I felt that I was a bad parent and that I was a poor parent for not being able to help him. I couldn't help him fight the demons that he had inside of himself to be able to teach him. But I was a very young parent, and I wasn't equipped with the knowledge that I needed to help him. So I turned to places like the courts and programs to try to help me with him. I begged people to help me with him, and they kept sending us to different places. And since I wasn't, I would say, savvy enough to learn how to work the system to be able to get him help he needed, the streets won. They won because he was just coming home from a teenage detention center. And he was very destructive with himself. And he started train surfing that night. It was the last night that I saw him. But on that evening, we were able to have a long conversation. And I asked him to promise me that starting tomorrow, we'll take him back to school. We'll start a new life. And unfortunately, he never survived. And that started my guilt, my depression, my, oh, my God, I don't know what I'm doing as a parent. how am I going to help him? How am I going to help my other son?
Yeah. Jonathan Kozel, you follow the children, but you've come to know the parents well in the process of doing that. And you describe just how bereft they are of resources in such horrible circumstances to raise these kids. What have you learned about parents, the challenge they're up against in this kind of environment? What works, what doesn't?
Well, there's a pattern in America among less enlightened people to say, well, it's the parents' fault, whatever happened. They blame the parents for bad schooling also. It's their fault. They didn't read to their children. This is almost never true. Almost all the parents I know, like Ariella, love their children and did everything they could, but they were themselves demoralized by the crippling conditions under which they were living. Now, Ariella was one of the few I knew who to this day has battled against depression and triumphed over it. She's a very strong, I feel embarrassed saying this as she's listening.
Don't
she's
be.
A very strong, warm, generous,
we can hear it,
competent human being, and she goes to universities now, and they'll ask her to come and speak, and she can hold her own against against any doctoral student. She has taught me far more than I've been able to teach her.
Ariella, where did you find that strength not to succumb to the depression and to keep going?
With the power of God and the ability to say, I didn't want to be my mother. I was raised in a very poor and hard condition, which I was a victim of a victim because my mother was also a victim of many, many things, which made her an alcoholic, and I was part of that. So I fought very hard not to be like her, and I wanted to raise my children differently. I wanted to give them the stability and the good home and the love and the knowledge that they didn't have. And through my books, because I'm an avid reader and I read a lot, so I tried to live and raise my kids that way. God was very powerful because I was angry at him for a while for taking my son. But I realized that it wasn't my doing. It wasn't my fault. It was just the circumstances of what we were in. And we were in an era where there was no support. I didn't have that support system that I needed. And when he passed away, I've had to look for it, and I started my journey on improving my life and my children's life. But unfortunately, I didn't have the resources that other children in suburban areas had, that other mothers had. I didn't have that support system. I had my church family. I had great, many, many people that I met. I worked. I didn't do drugs. I didn't drink. Yeah. So I wasn't your normal, typical person that they would say, oh, she's just a ghetto mom. I wasn't. I worked very hard to provide for my family. Unfortunately, we don't make enough. I was sort of classified as a middle class because I was able to make a little bit more than the regular area income. And I was able to give my children a different side of what life was.
May I make a comment?
Ultimately
quickly?
Able to do that, but having lost one and in a way, too.
When Ariella was earning $12,000 a year when I first met her, she was among the wealthiest people in the neighborhood. But when she speaks of not having the resources that she needed, a good example is this. A wealthy family with a son like Silvio, who was on a self-destructive path, would have brought him to a wonderful psychiatrist, not simply a social worker in a detention center, but to a private psychiatrist.
Somebody help
who would
here, please.
Maybe talk to him three times a week and get to know him well. All that was unavailable in the South Bronx. It still is almost impossible to obtain, even though they're just three or four subway stops away from the Upper East Side of Manhattan, where people like Woody Allen can see the shrink five times a week. She did a great job with her younger kids, though. She has two younger boys, and she's done a good job with them.
Once she found her footing on the road, the story is told in Jonathan Kozol's Fire in the Ashes. Ariella Patterson, it's very generous of you to share something of your story with us today, and we are grateful for it, and we wish you the best of luck and continued luck there. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. And if any moms that are feel that it's hopeless, there is no hopelessness. There's help out there. You just have to fight for it, and you have to go strong and never give up. I deal with that every day. My resources are very limited. My hopes and dreams are constantly shattered, but I never give up, and I don't want anyone to ever give up.
Our deep admiration for that, and our thanks for your time, Ariella Patterson. Thank you very much for joining us today. Jonathan Kozol, please stand by. We've got lots of listeners responding to this conversation. Daniel in Norfolk, Virginia. Daniel, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks
Hi.
For taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I've been listening to most of your panel, and I couldn't agree more. My situation is almost exactly parallel to the one described by the panelist
yes.
concerning the woman and her son. I'm from Norfolk, Virginia. I'm African-American male.
Mm-hmm.
I attended grammar school in the 60s, and it was just horrible. My educational experience was just, like this lady said, it was just horrible.
Mm-hmm.
I can't think of a word that's
bad enough
that describes it. Yes,
mm-hmm.
yes. Somehow, my wife is an elementary school teacher also, and we're both African American, and she teaches in an urban school. Our children are privately educated at great sacrifice to us, and I guess we would be classified as middle class, but because we have to pay for our children's education, then we feel like we're poor. We cannot offer our kids.
And why private things. School, Daniel? Are the public schools still failing children like yours who are there?
The public school has not changed in our eyes since we were parts of it. I don't believe that I could read till I was 22 years old.
Wow.
Adequately enough to.
Mm-hmm.
I had dropped out of college and began to teach myself how to read because it was so frustrating.
I'd love to connect what Daniel said to what one of the children I know went through.
Mm-hmm.
When he spoke of the miserable education he underwent, the little girl I described, Pineapple,
mm-hmm.
was at a school where she had typically 36 children in her class each
mm-hmm.
year.
Mm-hmm.
And there's so many kids, and the school was also aesthetically ugly. It was a place you wouldn't want to be, you know. No grown-up I know would want to spend
mm-hmm.
a day there. Teachers kept quitting, so she had seven different teachers in her
two years of school.
Third and fourth grade
mm-hmm.
year. By fifth grade, she had been artificially retarded by the city of New York. She could talk beautifully, but she couldn't write a sentence of five words.
But Daniel in Norfolk says this is still going on today.
Well, it is, and it's still going on today. It's the same thing now. In fact, she had 36 kids in her class. Last week in Los Angeles, a teacher came up to me in tears and said, I have 45 in my class. But the thing with Pineapple is she did prevail in the end because some of us intervened and we did just what Daniel did. Even though we believe in public education, we pulled her out and put her into an expensive boarding school up here in New England, and that led to her entering college.
I don't know how often that can happen, but we're going to come back and hear that story. Daniel in Norfolk, thanks for your call. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about America's poorest children and what happens in their lives with a man who's tracked them for years, very up close and personal. Jonathan Kozol is with us. He's written Savage Inequalities, Amazing Grace, Death at an Early Age, and many more. His new book is Fire in the Ashes, 25 Years Among the Poorest Children in America. Jonathan Kozol is with me in the studio. A couple of callers, so many coming in. New York City, Kathy's calling. Kathy, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you so much, mm-hmm. and I have so appreciated your work over many years. I am a pediatrician who was in training in New York City during those years you're talking about today. And I wanted to just bring up an issue which I think is increasingly important. What we're describing is really trauma in children, mm-hmm. and that they develop what we now call PTSD, which actually back in the 70s was not a term that was used so
right.
frequently. And I really think that I just want to ask you this question. I think it's time for the neuroscientists to talk to the social scientists. There have been such dramatic understanding about changes, permanent changes in the brain, and how do we intervene to perhaps mitigate those in some way. And it is things like psychotherapy, but it's many, many different modalities. We're really becoming more aggressive about looking at that. Because
is this a hopeful thing, Kathy, or an unhopeful thing? If it's
I think it's very hopeful. I think that, in fact, if we see the changes that we can see changes with some of these techniques with, you know, functional MRIs now
yeah.
are showing changes with many techniques. But I really think we need to look upon this in a sort of social medical model and to intervene. What is resiliency on a kind of neurological basis?
Let's pick it up with our, like, super social scientist observer here. Kathy, I appreciate your call. What about the plasticity of the mind, the human mind,
yes.
the brain we know about? It can go for good or ill. I mean, in trauma, it can really be damaged.
Well,
can it be brought back? Is that a piece of this, or is that do you want the medicalization of this as part of the answer?
Kathy sounds quite brilliant, but I disagree with her on this. I mean, I'm the son of a psychiatrist. I grew up in the world of neuroscience, son of a neurologist.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, there may be some contribution to be brought to bear mm-hmm. by her field of study. But in the long run, there's only one way to make a dramatic change in the lives of the poorest kids in America, and that's by giving them absolutely spectacular education, starting not just in kindergarten but in the preschool years, as they do in many other more enlightened democracies, and not to shunt it off to other factors that might damage them. Because if we do that, we'll feel impotent to do the only thing we can do.
The foundational thing.
We can't give them back their infancy again. We can't turn back the clock and give them parents who had good educations, because we robbed their parents 20 years before in separate and unequal schools.
Mm.
We can't bring a vast, sudden demographic change that integrates all these bastions of apartheid.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's not a single white child in the schools in the neighborhood where Ariella
yeah.
lives. We can't change those things. So I think there's a tendency for people to say, well, is it really the schools? Look at all the other factors.
Yeah.
I say, look, there are a lot of other factors, but I'm a teacher, and I'm going to take action in the place where I know that I can make a difference.
Make it so robust.
We can make schooling so robust, so enlightened, I don't mean by the mania of testing kids to death. I mean giving them the same exciting cultural experience that we give to kids in the best suburbs of America, small class size and teachers who are treated with respect.
We could do all of this. Can we do this with our political system?
Yes.
Have we ever done it?
Well, if I were education secretary, this is what I would be arguing for. I was asked once when Hillary was running, Hillary Clinton, mm-hmm. because I knew her and she'd visited the mm-hmm. neighborhood, I was asked by someone if I'd like to be her education secretary, and I said, probably not, but I would like to be king for 1 month.
But we don't have a king. We might not even have an education secretary if certain Republican politicians have their way.
Well, even with one, the fact is that here's the long-range answer. The only way we're ever going to give the poorest kids in America a really spectacular, life-changing education that can, instead of just using the phrase, that can really close the gap between the races in this nation. Only way we're ever going to do it is by getting away from our reliance on the wealth or poverty of local cities or states, because there's too much.
The property tax is the basis.
And there's too much unevenness. I was just in West Virginia where there's no way they can, with so much depression because of the mining industry declining, there's no way they can ever pay for the kind of education you can get in Connecticut.
What about charter schools or privatizing education?
The whole problem with charter schools, and I've seen a few good ones, is, first of all, on average, they are slightly less effective than regular public schools. We hear about the boutique versions, the ones that get extra money from philanthropists, but most of them are not as good or no better than the local public schools. But the main thing is that they're selective. They don't admit it, but they are selective.
And who comes in the first place?
Yeah, they'll say, we really like your little boy, Mrs. Jones, but we don't think we have the special needs services to deal with his problems. And if they do admit a child who has serious problems, they toss him out. They counsel him into leaving and going back to the public system. I don't think in the long run privatizing our public system is either a practicable solution for more than a handful of children, nor do I think it's ultimately in the national self-interest, because the parent who sends her or his child to a charter school no longer has any commitment to the public schools that still serve.
Many charter schools are public schools, though, right?
Well, they're private public schools. Yeah. I call them hybrid schools, and especially the ones that are run for profit by corporations. Mm. And this whole business of privatizing the public system in the long run is very risky, because it's too selective. It's too I'll add one other point briefly. Mm. I don't think it's not so much an issue of charter schools themselves. It's the whole idea that privatizers, the corporations, are very eager to humiliate the public system. That's the main reason they're giving so many of these relentless high-stakes tests to children year after year after year. The tests they're giving, these standardized exams, bubble tests, people will remember from schooling. These tests have do nothing to benefit a child's education. For one thing, the results don't come back usually till the end of the year, so the teacher can't make any use of them.
But at least there's some measure parents can see, we're told, whether the school is educating their kid or just holding them prisoner.
But it's not a measure of that. All it measures is whether the teachers at that school were willing to abandon their principles as educators and drill children for exams during the school year.
Scott in Spokane, Washington. Scott, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thanks, Tom. Mm-hmm. Excellent show. Thanks for all your fantastic work over the years. Mm. A few things come to mind. There's a lot of talk about the educational system and where it's failing and what the problems are. And I submit that it's more complex than that. The educational system is both a symptom and the problem itself. And the point that I wanted to make is that there is no one single solution to these problems that have been described. And as easy and as nice as it would be to say, well, the problem is we just need to fix the educational system, I can tell you from personal experience that many of the kids that Mr. Kozol has described, they're damaged in many different ways, and it's very difficult to tell how and how deeply they're damaged. And in some situations, even though those children are damaged, they can function in an educational system, and they can overcome their problems. But there are a lot of kids who can't. And when they get into the educational system, they act out, and it changes the schools, and it changes them, and sometimes the schools are blamed for that. I think it's a more complex problem than just saying it's the schools. There are a lot of things leading up to it. that would need to be taken care of in more of a social services environment.
Scott, I appreciate your call. This seems to be part of the debate in Chicago. Maybe how much can teachers really be responsible for? What do you say?
I don't scapegoat the teachers. I do say the society is responsible for flagrantly shortchanging the kids in those schools by giving them huge class size, by giving them a regimen of nonstop proto-military drilling for exams instead of real education, the kind that you would get in any good suburb in this country. The flagrant inequalities in funding for these schools are the shame of this nation.
Is it enough to overcome if they
yes.
come from out of all the trauma you describe?
Because the heart of the trauma in the long run is not what happened to them in the first couple of years of life. If we worry about that, we ought to have universal Head Start.
Yes.
But leaving that out, the most traumatic thing these kids undergo is attending a destructively separate and unequal school system. And Pineapple survived only because we pulled her out and sent her to a really good, expensive, rich kids' prep school.
How many kids can that be done for?
It can't, and that's the point. It's a great story. Pineapple's success is terrific. She's entering her final year of college next
Fantastic.
Year. And she's about to get certified to be a teacher and go back to the South Bronx.
And she's a bright light.
But you can't make
So what's the moral of the story if it took a complete exit from this whole environment?
The moral of the story is not that we should selectively pick out charming little kids and give them special opportunities. The moral of the story is that every public school in a destitute community ought to provide children with the same resources that saved Pineapple's soul.
Margaret in Oklahoma City. Margaret, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Uh-huh. I'm from Oklahoma City. I have a couple of questions that are very important to me. I'd like to know which factors, other than class size, because in a brief side note, I went to school when I was in school. I never had a class through eighth grade that was less than 42 pupils, and yet we didn't have these same problems. Obviously, I'm in my late 40s, so I'm from another generation than those that are growing up now. So my two questions are, one, what are the positive factors that could cooperate with large class size to have students be more successful? What are the additional negative factors? It cannot be class size alone. It just can't.
Yeah.
That are contributing to this downward spiral. And also a very important question, because I'm in education administration as well. What makes a master teacher? I remember two or three master teachers in my own life. It almost wouldn't have mattered what subject they were teaching because they knew their subject. They could extemporaneously apply their subject to, well, you know, it's just like you and yours. It's just like to the student's daily life.
Margaret, they're great questions. Our time is short. I appreciate your call from Oklahoma City. Jonathan Kozel, class size.
I totally,
and then master teacher.
I love to disagree with people, and I disagree with her totally. The fact is, yeah, it may be that 20 or 40 years ago, class size was not so devastating, but the world has changed. And these
Why would it be worse now?
Well, first of all, we're talking about kids who are destitute, who are destitute at a scale most Americans cannot imagine. For kids in that situation, a class size of 15 or 16 or 18 kids can make a can make a marvelous difference. Pineapple went from a class of 36 in the South Bronx to a class of 15 at an expensive school.
Does it take super teachers, master teachers to accomplish? How do we produce a population of those?
I don't think it takes super teachers. I certainly wasn't a super teacher. It takes good teachers who are well respected and well treated by their administrators, they're not blamed for all the for the shortage of funds and all the other problems that afflict their schools. That's what's happening today, and my heart goes out to the teachers, to be honest.
Stephanie in Beverly, Massachusetts. Stephanie, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom. Thank you. So many good points are being brought up, and I just want to shed a little bit of light that while the problem may be extreme in the poverty-stricken section, the hidden secret is that the middle class is disintegrating. And our children, believe it or not, many of them are traumatized and destroyed by schools. We have a 13-year-old who was, I cannot tell you how destroyed, bright, gentle kid with dyslexia. We sold our house to give him a couple of years at a private school that works well with that. It's changed his life, and we are now out of money. So here we are, middle-class suburban people, and it is a myth that the suburban schools are doing such a good job, because even though our children are not subject to the extreme living conditions and neighborhood conditions, the educational conditions are a disaster.
Stephanie, I appreciate your call. We have just 1 minute. Jonathan Kozel, can this country afford to do for all what you describe here? Can we afford not to? How do we make this happen?
I'm convinced we can afford to do it. That's why I was joking before when I said I'd love to be king for 1 month. The fact is, if we took the billions of dollars that we're now squandering on the testing industry to relentlessly measure our children month after month, and turn the whole school year into drilling for exams. We took all that money and we put it into public schools for poor children to reduce class size and treat their teachers well. That probably would make a bigger difference in reducing poverty than any other thing I can think of in America. And if people want to learn more about my thinking and where I'm going to be speaking the next few weeks, may I mention my website is jonathankozel.com.
Boston, be in Chicago, and the kids who you supported and written about, they now support you.
They call me up all the time, want to know what I'm doing.
The new book is Fire in the Ashes, 25 Years Among the Poorest Children in America. Jonathan Kozel, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. This has been a wonderful hour.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.